of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, April 14th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is the Majority Report. I am broadcasting live from the Mass Torts Convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. And, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you could completely understand that I... You got to be more explicit. Scott Milliken, the producer of Ring of Fire, is here, and he's helping me out, and he's signaling to me, and I don't understand what he's saying.
What?
Too loud?
It's a little loud.
Little loud. All right. Fair enough. And so bear with me, folks. A little bit tricky here today because I'm on the road, and I don't know how to operate the equipment, which dramatically impacts my ability to do the show. And but fortunately, so I'm wandering around the casino last night, completely broke. I had been mugged by a blackjack dealer as I was, of course, prepping for the show. What I meant to say was I was prepping for the show, and somebody broke into my hotel room and stole all of the money that I had meant to gamble with, which is the story I'll be telling my wife. And, of course, I'm walking down the middle of the casino and sort of lying there in the fetal position, just sort of rocking back and forth. Cliff Schechter, ladies and gentlemen. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you. Is my sound okay right now?
Your sound is okay. Maybe a little bit hot. I think there we go.
I can get out of the fetal position. I'll sound better.
Now, Cliff, of course, was not in the fetal position. He was. He is also attending this conference, and well, I should tell people what it is. It's basically it's a huge sort of gathering of trial lawyers talking about how more efficiently to essentially go after corporations. And I've said many times on the program that, you know, I see trial lawyers as the last vestige of sort of protection for consumers and workers in an age where we have intense regulatory capture and in an age where, you know, to the extent we have any regulation.
Yeah, let me agree with that, Sam. It's just people don't know how important it is because these guys, they take on the corporations that poison us, that rip us off. You know, that it's the reason why Karl Rove and his ilk have gone after them with this bogus thing they try to call tort reform, which is nothing more than making sure people that are hurt stay hurt. And they take money out of the pockets of people that they're trying to make corporations pay for what they do to us. So I'm actually really happy to be here, too.
And it's actually, there's a two-pronged attack, you know, when Karl Rove gets involved, because, you know, while the guys like the Koch brothers and just corporations in general will push for so-called tort reform, which basically means less access to citizens who have been hurt, like you say, to courts to get any type of remuneration. But the other aspect, frankly, from Karl Rove's perspective is if you can go after the trial lawyers, you are going to dry up a very, very big funding source for Democratic lawmakers.
Which is, of course, exactly what his plan is and what he does. I'd say a third important thing to say is, after dealing with Karl Rove, is you have to get that Karl Rove smell off of you. And
yeah,
that can be a very challenging endeavor. I kind of compare it to, we need to take that tomato juice bath after the skunk. So I think...
Have you ever run into Karl Rove? Have you ever had any interaction with him?
I have never spoken to him. I have run into him places. Not physically, thankfully, but yes, I've been in the same room as him.
I was at the RNC in 2004, and we were videotaping, and I was talking to Stephen Elliott. You know Stephen Elliott? He's the author, and he was doing a book on the campaign trail, and he was sitting down like in like a hallway in one of these conference rooms. It was down like the bowels of Madison Square Garden, I guess. And he's sitting there, and he's typing away on his computer, And Karl Rove walks up to him and basically, as Stephen Elliott, if I don't know if you know of anything about his background, but he's engaged in the sex industry a decent amount. And he said, I swear to God, when that dude came up to me, it was completely. And he started talking to Stephen Elliott, like, started saying, like, whoa, what's that? It's a computer. Like, the creepiest. And Stephen Elliott is convinced that that he was getting hit on. I think actually that's even in the.
We all do remember, you know, that famous story of Karl Rove seeing George Bush across the room. And I'm not even making a joke. This is how he described it, apparently falling in love, realizing that this, you know, I think Karl Rove has always had a bit of a crush on George W. Bush. And I think that's part of his hatred for anything gay is that he can't admit it to himself.
Yeah, well, that's usually the way it works with the big homophobes. It is
it's the wide stance theory.
Exactly. They are the self-loathing that they feel inside because of the shame. They've just learned to turn outward.
But I'd like to say, if Karl Rove is thinking of suing me, that that was not intended to be a factual statement.
yes.
So whatever I say obviously has no meaning to it.
We used to have a, and I want to recycle it, but we used to have a liner at the beginning of the show. Is like something to the effect of, like, you know, conservatives are horrible, but just kidding. But many a truth told in jest, but not so much that one could get sued for it.
And I think that's the perfect line you need
right.
to skate. I like it, Sam.
Yes, you need to be able to have that legal. Of course, we are in a room full of trial litigators. So
that's true.
It may maybe this is the place to cross those bounds.
That's
all right, so look, I don't have sound today, folks, in terms of like clips, because I can't figure out how to work it. I mean, I know it's there, but so I don't have the sound clips of Obama's speech. But let's talk about this speech. I was able to catch it on actually my flight out here. And I have to say, folks, going into this speech, and I want to be careful here in the way that I phrase this, but going into the speech, I was expecting something much worse. And this is, let's just discuss this from the premise of, I don't think that we have anything but a revenue problem in this country, A, and B, I don't think the deficit and debt it is a short-term or even a mid-term problem right now. The biggest problem we have is 8.8% unemployment, which, of course, is really just scratches the surface of what the real unemployment number is. We have stagnant wages over the past 30 years. And that, to me, is the crisis. But with that said, the speech, Cliff, I got to say, I was a little bit surprised.
I was, too. I got to admit that usually these days when Barack Obama goes into a negotiation, I'm scared. I half expect him to come out, like, if you've seen that commercial with the guy that agrees to hop on one leg for like 30 years because it's a dare. I think that Obama may come out hopping on one leg or performing. So. Okay, I'll get away from the joke. And get
right.
Serious.
Well, no, no. A joke. I just didn't know that commercial.
Oh,
you just got to get, you got to up the game up
a
little bit.
I really have to have better references, and I apologize for that. Yeah, basically,
Cliff lives in Ohio now, folks.
That's true.
Basically what it is. It's like it's ground zero for commercials.
I mean, my neighbor on my left is a cow, and my neighbor on the right is a college coach who's paying off his players. So, you know, that's part of living in Columbus, Ohio.
There you go. And that's only in an elementary school, right?
I mean,
they really started earlier.
I would say, actually, within the parameters that President Obama has set up, I was very pleased with the speech.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, of course, to me, what really struck me was that this is almost more of the launching of his political campaign.
Yes.
Than it was a policy measure, because, you know, we don't know where the policy is going to end up.
Right.
I mean, even if we could trust Obama to stick to his guns, we don't know where the policy is going to end up. So what I liked about the speech was that he made a very strong case to raise taxes, and
yes.
Not just like a call for it, but a strong case, almost making a pretty full-throated defense of liberalism.
Yes,
in that context, and that's something I mean, have we heard anything from that from him about that?
If we have, not in a long time. And I would say that's what it was. It's that this is like what I've been waiting for. In other words, I don't agree with everything about that speech, because I would say, and we can talk more in detail if we want about this, that I like you, I think the deficit reduction thing is a fetish. It's a Washington game. It's silly. Social Security has no problems for another 30 years, and all this stuff can be handled. Get rid of the Bush tax cuts tomorrow, no problem. Cut defense by a third so that we only spend as much as about 70% of the other nations on the earth combined.
Right.
No problem. You know, get rid of the farm subsidies, the part that goes to just agribusiness or oil subsidies, no problem. And let's not even get into the wars. So that would be, I would say, is my problem with even having this conversation. But if we're going to have it, I very much like the way he stood up. And, you know, this is what I hoped he would do from the beginning, because this whole I'm above it all and, oh, you know, some Democrats say this, some Republicans say that he's done in the past drives me nuts. He is a Democrat. He's the leader of our party. He stands up for principles that he claims to espouse. And that's what I want to hear him do.
Right.
And so, yes, I will hold him to the policy, because in the past, sadly, he's made some speeches and then hasn't always been there.
Right.
But if he does, at least rhetorically, this is what I want. This is what we stand for. This is the insanity they stand for. Choose. It's a choice.
Yes. You know, and when he came out during the campaign and said, there are things I admire about Ronald Reagan, et cetera, et cetera. That's the part that I thought he was talking about, the part
right.
where he could go out and create a narrative that, you know, whereas Reagan created this narrative for a lot of people in our generation,
yep.
That government is bad, that it's good to pick on people,
welfare queens,
and et cetera, et cetera. You know, I was waiting for Obama, regardless. I'd never had very high hopes in terms of what he'd be able to achieve from a policy standpoint. The country was so effed up after 10 years of Bush that, you know, this is a long-term project to reclaim, you know, some semblance of the country we had. But one thing I was hoping is that he is going to lay a predicate that may show returns 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, because you have a whole series of generation of people who start to understand the reason why we need taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, a couple of things that stuck out for me in the speech that were really, I thought, impressive was, one, he made a point of saying, the Social Security is not responsible for our deficit.
Right.
And that's a really important statement to have on record from the president. The other thing he's talking about is that taxes are a lower percentage of GDP. Now, I don't know if I projected on this, or I can't remember now if he actually said that. But taxes are a lower part of GDP than they've been since 1950 or so.
He definitely said in half a century, I think, is what he said.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that just to get that out there, I mean, I spend every moment I can when I do one of those, you know, TV shows, that's the only thing I want to talk about. And
right.
I wedge it into, you know, like Charlie Sheen. Yeah, Charlie Sheen knows
right.
that.
No,
and it's nice to hear the president talk that way.
Right, it is. I mean, that's the thing, is that conservatives, we hear all the time how they want to climb in a DeLorean and go back to the 1950s, and yet that was when Eisenhower had the top tax rate at 91%. Kennedy, they love Kennedy. They try to claim that, we, you know, Reagan did what Kennedy did, which was to cut marginal tax rates, not ever saying that Kennedy cut them down first to 77% and then 70%.
Well,
nothing like what we've got today.
Well, and it's also not just a question of, if you look at the effective tax rate, because he cut the tax rate, but he closed a bunch
That's
of
a
loopholes. And so if you look at the effective tax rate, the change is completely is nominal.
Right.
It's
so,
not.
So there is a big point why we can't afford all this stuff. It's simple. We had a great formula that worked for this country for 50
yep.
years and made this the strongest country on the earth with the most prosperous middle class. And that formula said that those that have benefited from the safety and security this country provides, so they can start businesses and they can rely on contracts and other items, well, you know, and they don't have to worry about someone just bashing their door down and coming. Well, the whole point is that social contract they benefited from, they deserve to give a little, you know, we deserve for them to give a little more back to fund the types of things that make our civic society work. And that was accepted. And that's why people always need to look pre-Reagan. And this is what I thought from Obama, too, is that he was going to remind people of this. That's why some people got angry when he said, that he looked to Reagan almost, you know, because Reagan always said that he emulated FDR, and it was, I think, for a similar reason. So I thought he was going to put the counter narrative to Reagan's narrative and say, you know, government isn't the problem. Government, for many of the most least fortunate out there, often has to be the answer.
Yes.
Government is what binds us all together.
And frankly, it's not even a question of the least fortunate. You know, over 60% of Americans rely on Social Security for over 50% of their retirement income.
Great point.
And so, you know, if that's the least amongst us, we're all the least amongst us.
Right.
And, you know, I watched last night on Hardball. I mean, I'm so screwed up with the time zone. I got here. And there was some function that was at 6 p.m. locally here, and I showed up at 3:30 in the afternoon. And I'm just so messed up. But I saw a Hardball last night. I saw Ed Rollins on there going like, you know, he said tax the rich. Now, I'm not one of the rich. I got news for you. There's no doubt in my mind Ed Rollins is one of the rich.
I remember reading his book, and he was talking about at some point how, you know, somebody asked him to come take a political job. He's like, I can't. I'm making $400,000 a year. Now that,
right.
That's $400,000 a year in the 1980s.
Right.
So, you know what I mean?
Well, he could have spent it all on porn, I guess.
Well,
but,
yeah, right.
You know, the it's fascinating to hear. I mean, I think that's the one thing that, you know, sort of is so clear when you hear one CNN analysis of it was like, you know, he's talking about 250,000. A lot of people say there are certain parts of the country where $250,000 a year is middle class. And, you know, I mean, look, I live in New York, and there have been times where I've made that amount of money. I've had one or two years was more. Most of the years I've lived in New York, it's been less. And I can tell you that you can still make it in New York on $250,000 a year in income.
You can do that.
It's not such a now, can you send your kids to private schools for $30,000 a year? No, you can't. But guess what? Neither can 99.9% of the rest of the country.
Right. And it's important to note that also there's no law, there's no constitutional element stopping them from redefining, you know, where we decide, you know, those tax cuts go. I mean, the truth is, when you hear the top 400 families or have as much money as the 150
right.
million Americans,
right.
Well, what about a surtax? What about saying, if people don't want to tax people make $250,000 in an additional amount, I actually can listen to that argument and understand if you've got a family. But to not tax people more who made $600 million last year?
Right.
Who, you know, I mean,
or tax over millionaires.
Right.
I mean, if we were taxing...
A millionaire surtax that really got at it could bring in so much money, it would be amazing.
I say this almost every day, but if we were taxing anyone making over $1 million a year at the same rate we were in 1961, effective tax rates, they'd be paying 20 percentage points more of their income in two taxes, and we would have $362 billion a year extra.
See?
$362 billion a year extra.
Think of how important. I mean, with that, we could probably not only bomb Yemen, but my guess is that we could step up and bomb a couple of Latin American countries,
We could
too.
Afford that so many bombs. Do you have any idea how many places we could bomb if we spent all of that $362 billion?
I mean, I'm joking, and yet you make a great point. And to me, when I look at the sort of broader set of issues, my problem is that this is endemic in everything. This is why there needed to be a new narrative. And see, the narrative from the late 70s, 80s on was everybody's in this alone, screw the other guy.
Right.
You're all, and, you know, the issues I work on, tax fairness is one of them. Another issue that I work a lot on is on gun issues. And that's led sort of to this militia culture where everybody thinks they have to be out there defending themselves with an assault weapon because they don't trust the police, they don't trust the government, they don't trust anything, because this is the kind of narrative we got out of the Reagan years and the
right.
Gingrich Congress, which is everybody's on their own. And so, like, to me, it's hurt us economically, it's hurt us socially. You know, right now, after the insanity, you know, sorry to harp a little bit on a pet issue of mine, but the insanity of what happened in Tucson, we still can't get these guys to say that criminals and mentally unstable people should be subject to background checks
right.
at all gun shows. You know, somehow that's taking away, I don't know whose freedom that's taking away. I would say, I like to say that I think Christina Taylor Greene, the 9-year-old who was killed there, had more freedom to live than somebody had freedom to not have a background check when buying a gun.
Right.
And so that's why this is all important to me, because this is all weaved into an important narrative of how we become this nation of people that just all think we're on our own. We need to remember we are in it together, how the other person, what happens to you, does affect me.
Right. And, you know, so he gets some points for that. And then, of course, we have to see where it's going from there. But I want to just, you know, touch on this on one more thing before I delve into some stories here. And we're going to I'm going to interview Peter Mouget again, who I've spoken to in the past, who's one of the attorneys from Papantonio's firm. And apparently there's a new ruling on rules for disclosure for financial advisors. He's going to talk about a little bit, which is pretty interesting stuff, because I just watched Inside Job on the – it was a long airline flight. Thank God Virgin has those little TVs there, because they didn't have internet. But let me ask you this, because with all the sort of like, you know, I don't know what the – I guess if you're, you know, you've been – if you're a raccoon that's out in the snow for 6 months, and all of a sudden you run across like a garbage pail full of crappy old food, you're going to be happy. And on some level, there's sort of that reaction.
Mike Huckabee might find you and throw you in a popcorn.
That's right. But
he may fry you right up.
And to a certain extent, that's my reaction to Obama's speech. I mean, it's just nice to hear him put out this rhetoric and put down some of these markers about taxation, about the interconnectedness. With that said, he's been horrible on civil liberties.
Yes.
He has been horrible on financial regulations and making holding the banks accountable, which is a rather important issue.
Well, we'd rather not have a repeat of a couple
exactly.
Years ago.
And I think there's every reason to believe that we will. It's just a question of when.
Well, I mean, when you hear the stories of the guys who make $400 million off of, and I wish I could remember the name of who I was reading about, and I don't want to, I was one of the big insurance guys, but $400 million and then ended up paying like a 20-something million fine.
Right.
You know, I mean, and then you're not prosecuted, then what becomes the motivation not to do it again?
Right. And not only on an individual basis, but on a systemic basis, we're providing more government assurances that if you guys fail again, we've made all the too-big-to-fail banks even bigger.
Right.
Than that to fail. And so.
But it's important to say that this, the banks, civil liberties, again, these all could have been weaved into that broader narrative about how Americans were in
it
together.
If he cared.
Yeah. I'll just say quickly, I don't want to cut you off, Sam. When I argue with people that support Obama now, and I say to them, the big thing that drives me crazy is that this is what I expect. I don't expect I'm going to agree with him on every policy.
Right.
Of course not. And there are times he'll disappoint me, and there are times where I'll just say, hey, maybe he convinced me I'm wrong. It's the broader sort of cultural change we need.
Right, exactly.
You know, and that's – okay.
Setting that narrative. No. And so – but with that aside, I have an emailer wrote me about this story, which I had seen in America blog, that – you know, it was posted by somebody who I guess has started their own blog and was basically calling for a primary of Obama and making an interesting case, sort of really attacking the notion that, well, if you primary him, you'll weaken him. A primary could win, actually.
That's true.
Against Obama. This is the argument that you need to set up future candidates. And if Obama's going to lose anyways, you're going to want somebody who's going to come in 4 years later.
Yeah.
But this emailer has also a good counter narrative to that, which is that Obama still has an 84% approval rating among black voters. It may actually be even higher than that.
I wouldn't be surprised.
He still, my understanding is, self-identified Democrats, even self-identified liberal Democrats, give him about an 80% approval rating. And so I guess my question is to you is, like, how fucked up is it that – I mean, isn't this the problem? Is that on the Democratic side, there's just not as much – they're just not paying attention in the same way that they do on the right. Now, on the right, they pay attention, but they, you know, pay attention to people who are telling them lies. On the left, it just seems like just people aren't paying attention.
Well, here's what I think. Somebody wrote this on a listserv on the other day, and I think it makes the argument. The right – because they built this huge infrastructure of media and talking points, and you know, you look back to 1973, a wonderful year when we had Nixon doing what he was doing, but Heritage Foundation has created, ALEC, you know, is created, you know, the American Legislative, what does it stand for? These guys that plan out all the state legislative regressive moves they're going to pull. Everything from taxes to guns to abortion to, I mean, when you start seeing this stuff happen in a number of different states, it's not by accident. Right. These guys plan it out. So they built all this infrastructure, and we didn't. And it seems like what the right can do, it's almost like they've got this big apparatus. So they can just plug somebody in. It almost doesn't matter. I mean, it matters to a certain degree who it is. But on our side, we almost have to get a messiah complex behind whoever the leader is, because the leader is the one where everything comes from, because we don't have the Fox News. We don't have the Rush Limbaugh.
So we don't have an ongoing sort of like systemic message machine.
Right, because I think what you're saying, and we need it, and I think what you're saying is it speaks to a huge problem, because I agree. Look, I don't want to call people dumb, and there are people who disagree with me who look at the same stuff and say, I think what Obama's done is great. That's their right. But I do think, you know, in my humble opinion, I do think that a lot of that approval rating is just because people just trust Obama because he's Obama.
Right.
They're not really looking at the fine print. He's the Democrat. He's our guy. And they're not looking at the fact that a lot of the promises that he made, you know, that are important to some people, civil liberties are important. I mean, some of these things, you know, he's not living up to.
No.
And I think a primary challenge, quite frankly, would be healthy, because at the very least, I mean, the example I love to use is Blanche Lincoln. She was terrible, but during the time she was being primaried, suddenly her derivatives legislation was amazing.
Right.
That, you know, if we're not going to get what we want from Obama, I'll tell you, at least during the year and a half he had to contend with a primary, he'd be passing legislation much further to the left.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at has to do more with how is it his numbers are still there? I mean, I get, you know, like, I see what you're saying, is that the only thing that animates the left to a certain extent, because we don't have an ongoing message machine in the way that the right does, which is funded by, you know, billions of dollars of very wealthy people's
Coke
money.
Coke money.
Right. And that I also think that there's a physiological problem on some level, that liberals, by their very DNA, essentially want government to work well, want to vote for these people that they trust, and then walk away and do the other things that almost by definition make them liberal.
Right.
You know, they want to be interested in it, whereas on the right, you're talking literally at least the base, you know, at least the 30% they go by Tea Partiers now. 15 years ago, they were, you know, a moral majority, whatever they're calling themselves at any given moment. They are literally zealots. And their lives are defined by this mission that is religious, and both small r and generally large r.
Yep, and there's no doubt that's a big part of the problem. I think progressive also, you know, because we do believe in government, and it's a good thing, don't want to corrupt it. The right's willing to do anything, obviously,
right,
to get to where they want to be. See Wisconsin Supreme Court election.
Right.
And so I think that becomes a big problem. But I really do think the crux of it is, on both sides, most people, frankly, day-to-day, just aren't paying attention to this stuff the way we are. And so on the right, they know what they hear, and they hear from Rush Limbaugh that Obama was born in Kenya. And so that's what they know.
Right, when we know the truth was he was actually born in Ghana.
Exactly. He couldn't get across the border. They're giving him way too much credit. Whereas the right isn't necessarily hearing it from their leader. They're hearing it from Rush. They're hearing from Rush Limbaugh. The left isn't necessarily hearing it. We're hearing it from Obama. Because the truth is he's got a bigger microphone than anybody on our side, because we don't.
Right.
Well, your microphone's very big, so.
Right, thank you.
But we don't have, you know, the kinds of huge media apparatus and figures, although you're getting bigger every day, Sam. So maybe you'll get there.
Working on it. All right, before you go, got to get your take on just two things. One, your old buddy Rick Santorum has decided to throw his hat in the ring. This has got to be one of the most exciting days for you in a long time.
I am pretty excited.
He has announced officially forming his presidential exploratory committee last night on Greta Van Susteren's show. So we have Mitt Romney, Santorum, And apparently, I guess...
Palenty's in, isn't he?
Palenty accidentally announced. He was asked, are you trying to go for vice president? He goes, no, I'm going for president. And
oh, boy,
I'm not going for vice president. And then his people had to walk it back because he hadn't officially announced.
His whole life seemed kind of accidental.
No kidding. And Trump is going to announce on...
Is he really?
He's going to announce whether or not he's going to do it on the last episode of The Apprentice.
Of course, because that's all about. Well, I'll quickly say before I go, in terms of Santorum, we can all at least be happy that across the land, dogs are howling in anticipation of men climbing on them.
Yes.
When it comes to Donald Trump, I guess I've gone with too many Donald Trump hair jokes, so I'll
right.
stop there. But really, the man's a walking joke, so I don't even know what else to say.
I mean, it's almost as if the Republicans are like, hey, let's just keep enabling Obama to move to the right,
right.
by putting up these complete nuts. Stooges and nuts.
And actually, I will say that quickly, I am working on a column right now. I write one for Al Jazeera English, and the column is how Donald Trump is the embodiment of everything that's culturally wrong with America. In this one person.
And, you know, he was recognized that way in the 90s, I think, or the 80s. I mean, he got to a point where when he got bankrupt, he was sort of like, he and Helmsley were considered sort of like the bad end of everything that had happened, I think,
just BS,
in the 80s,
you know,
I think
famous,
it was. Maybe
so he
it was.
Gets to do stuff to,
right.
to reality TV, to extremism and demagoguery. Really, everything you can find that's wrong with our culture, you will find in the personage of Donald Trump.
All right. Well, Cliff, thank you so much for joining me today, helping me out. Hopefully we'll have you back tomorrow. I'll let you go and check
out. Mass torts.
Yes, exactly. And I'm just going to bring on Peter Mouget in just a second. Thank you, Cliff.
Hey,
I appreciate
Sam, thanks
it.
So much, buddy.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. And I'll bring on Peter Mouget in just a second. Let me just give you this. This is an interesting story just in the context of what we're going to be talking about a little bit with Peter Mouget, is that apparently a U.S. congressional report was released on Wednesday. And this was... I guess the Congressional Financial Report. It was the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Spent 2 years poring over documents, whatnot, and has determined that Moody's Corp, Standards and Poor's triggered the financial crisis when they were forced to downgrade the inflating ratings they had slapped on these mortgage-backed securities. Now, we all know that part of the story with the whole financial crisis was that these securities, after they were bundled by the different investment banks, were sent over to places like Moody's and Standard & Poor's to be rated. Standard & Poor's and Moody's rated all the pieces of crap as AAA ratings. And, of course, that allowed things like big statewide municipal pension funds to invest in them, which had there's a lot of these big institutional investors. They have internal... rules as to whether or not they can invest in a product, and it needs to be rated AAA. And so it caused loss of a lot of pensions, loss of a lot of hardship on seniors. And the staff for Senators Carl Levin and Tom Coburn wrote in the report, perhaps more than any single event, the sudden mass downgrades of residential mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations. These are the CDO's ratings were the immediate trigger for the financial crisis. Now, of course, this was just the straw that broke the camel's back. The report calls for radical reforms to the industry that are authorized in last year's Dodd-Frank financial reform law, but may not be realized because, of course, the Republicans are now attacking at every opportunity they can. Let me bring in Peter Mouget. Peter, of course, is a plaintiff's attorney with Levin Papantonio.
Right.
And speak right up into that mic and get you in there. How are we doing on Peter's levels? Are they all right? We good? Can you pick up Peter's levels? And you got to forgive me, folks, because I'm still working out the got a little blackjack thing here, and it works only fairly well. But so, Peter, we've talked in the past about, sort of the financial crisis, and particularly the failure of the Justice Department to be doing anything about it, and sort of the role that plaintiff litigators, trial lawyers like yourself, are playing in holding these people accountable through private suits and I guess through mass through torts, class action torts. Now, there's been a recent development in terms of the relationship of clients and financial advisors. Is that right?
There has. It's the debate over whether or not a uniform fiduciary duty would apply to both residential or investment advisors and broker-dealers. Let me give you a little color, a little background.
Okay, yeah, please.
Because most people really don't understand the difference. You've got registered investment advisors, what they call RIAs, and they can be licensed either under the state or under the SEC, depending on the size, amount of money that they manage. You also have broker-dealers, which is what most people think, you know, the Merrill Lynches of the world. And there's different standards.
All right, so wait, who are the first guys? Like, where do they work?
The first guys, and you can be both. You're not mute. There's some that are Series 7 or broker-dealers licensed that you like a Merrill Lynch.
Uh-huh.
And also, they can be registered investment advisors, RIAs.
Okay.
And those are what we call money managers. So if you go into a broker-dealer, and they refer you out to a money manager, that is an investment advisor, and they're licensed with the SEC, or if they're smaller, with the states. So you're dealing with two different parties, and there's different standards, but there's a lot of folks that will walk into a broker dealer's office, Merrill Lynch, and think that they're giving financial advice because the firms spend millions of dollars convincing people that we can give you a complete solution. Like most of us have walked into a Merrill Lynch and gotten a nice, pretty leather-bound booklet or something on your financial plan for the rest of your life. They're giving financial advice. They're packaging. They call themselves financial advisors.
But they don't have the same responsibility, fiduciary responsibility to the client that an RIA has? Is that it?
It depends on the state, but most states, a lot of states, the broker-dealers will argue that they have a lesser standard. There's no fiduciary standard. And what that essentially means is they'll argue that they don't have to put their interests behind the clients, that the client's interests don't come first. In a nutshell, that's it. So registered investment advisors have to put the client's interest first. Broker dealers do not.
And so this is basically the functional equivalent of a used car salesman whose state doesn't have a state lemon law, right? I mean, I don't have to tell you that this thing may have been pulled out of a swamp and been cleaned up, and I don't have to tell you any
that's
of that.
Exactly. Stuff. I mean, it's caveat emptor, but to let the buyer beware. Meaning, as you go in and sit down at Merrill Lynch, you have to figure out. You've got a duty to investigate. You have to check. So if there's a fiduciary duty, you don't have a duty to investigate. You can rely on what they're telling you. And what the Merrill Lynches, the UBSs of the world will say is, you should have figured out that we weren't telling you the whole story because we don't owe you a fiduciary duty.
Isn't this the dynamic? I mean, I just saw Inside Job, and a couple of things stuck out at me. But the whole dynamic where you had places like Goldman Sachs selling these securities at the same time betting against these securities. They're selling them to their clients as like, this is a good deal, this is a good investment for you. At the same time, they know they're bad because they're going out and actually doing side bets through AIG against these same securities they're selling. So and the one of the issues that people had with that is that you can't do that because you're basically creating a market to bet against by selling to your own clients, and you clearly don't have their interest, their best interest in it, because you're not hedging here. This is not the same as a hedge. You're actively getting the fees to sell a product. It's like basically me saying, like, I've got this fleet of cars that I pulled out of the swamps in New Orleans. I've cleaned them out, but I know one thing that happens is when you've had your cars underwater, carburetors go to hell after 6 weeks after I sell it. I'm going to also, not only am I going to sell these cars, I'm going to open up a carburetor shop around the corner.
Yeah. No, your example, the Goldman example is a really good example. But you know what? It's even cleaner than that. And it's not that they were betting on other side, both sides of the position. It's that they created that product. And they created the product to fail. They specifically picked those securities because they thought they were going to fail. That's what you call a short. They thought it was going to go down.
Right.
So they picked them to go down. And then they sold it to an investor without telling him, we designed this to fail. So They didn't.
So they went the opposite direction than I'm right. even talking about. They were more active in this.
They created that product to fail, and then they didn't tell the guy who bought it that these specific the mortgages they picked, the CDS, the default swaps, that they picked those to fail, but then didn't tell the person.
So it's the function of me selling you a car without a catalytic converter and having a shop that does the I have to put these in car metaphors. That does a shop that basically gives you an inspection sticker. You come in a week to get an inspection sticker. And I go, oh, you don't have a catalytic converter. Fortunately, I sell catalytic converters.
You know what the car example is? Because you know what they tell you that they're more the standard that a lawyer uses or
right.
a CPA. They position themselves that way. And the fraud is that behind closed doors, in the courtrooms, in the arbitration rooms that they force you into, then they say, oh, that's not the standard that applies. We'll spend millions of dollars telling you that's the standard in the marketing material, but behind closed doors, we're going to be used car salesmen. And that car salesman's a good example.
And we saw them testify in front of the Senate basically saying the same thing. That's not our responsibility. Each
that's
one
right.
of those heads of all those investment banking firms were like, if that happened, it's unfortunate, but that's not our responsibility.
Oh, it's infuriating. I mean, and you know what really is the institutional investors are. As a matter of fact, this morning we were discussing there's a Department of Labor issue right now with the ERISA standard on how broad fiduciary is.
ERISA, we should say, was the thing that was set up to basically protect pensions
right.
that private corporations set up.
And what essentially the proposal is that the investment advisors can opt out of that fiduciary standard, meaning, you know, we're not going to treat you as fiduciaries. All right. Here's the problem.
Wait, let's back up because I want to explain this to people. ERISA basically was set up in the early 70s to protect the pension. So in other words, corporations will make a deal with a union. We're going to pay you X.
That's right.
And we're going to supplement that with a pension. And when we invest in this pension for you, we're using certain numbers to anticipate how much that's going to grow. And if we use inflated numbers on the growth, we're going to end up underfunding that pension, and then it will have to go to the pension guaranteed trust. We'll pick it up if we go bankrupt or this and that. So ERISA basically says to the corporations, you have a responsibility to put a certain amount of money in and reasonable projections as to how far it's going to grow so we know these pensions are filled.
That's exactly right. So really what the end of the day is the states are the guarantors of these pension funds. Now, we think of pension funds as these huge state pension funds but they're actually smaller. Well, it depends how the states are set up. Like, for instance, in Florida, the firefighters of some small town in Florida can have a pension fund
right.
under ERISA, okay? So what the broker-dealers are saying is we don't want that fiduciary standard to apply. Now, if you're a state and you've got billions, not millions, billions of dollars, the institutional pension fund has the opportunity to negotiate. But if you're the firefighters of some small
right.
town, you don't have that leverage because you may only have 70 or 80 million bucks. And the government's done studies, the GAO, Government Accountability Office, that funds that operate with these conflicts that aren't disclosed. And keep in mind, no fiduciary duty means you don't have to disclose the conflicts. Fiduciary duty, you got to disclose.
Right.
The GAO has said the funds that are operating under these conflicts underperform those that don't by 150 basis points or 1.5%. Now, when you're talking millions, billions,
right.
you're talking about huge money. So the proposal now is...
Now, wait. Now, what do you perceive might be the reason for that? Is it because the guy who doesn't have the fiduciary responsibility to these funds says, like, hey, I could put them in this portfolio A, which may perform better, but portfolio B is structured in a way that I get more commissions?
That's it. It's the bottom line. This is driven by bottom line, and they are skimming the 50 basis points, 25, you know, 0.25, 0.5, and that's exactly it. You know, they will set up fee structures that create conflicts of interest, like commission recapture programs. But they'll create these fee structures that siphon off funds, and if there was a fiduciary duty, they'd have to tell the clients that, hey, look, this is costing you money. But they're not. They're going all around the country,
right.
and they're making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars setting up fee structures that benefit the broker-dealers to the detriment of our states, and don't tell them. And they don't disclose, and they don't disclose because they argue we don't have a fiduciary duty. And the smaller pension funds, A, they don't have the sophistication, B, they don't have the leverage to negotiate,
right,
are the ones getting screwed. And it's happening all over, and they're trying to shrink this fiduciary standard. So what's going on right now under Dodd-Frank is there's a proposal by the SEC. They issued a 246-page report. Pretty thorough, pretty extensive, and they're recommending that they should use a uniform fiduciary standard, kind of a floor, that in this investment advisor relationship.
So anybody who sells you any type of investment would be subject to this floor
exactly
of responsibility.
Right. They're selling investment advice, so anybody that sells investment advice, it doesn't matter what hat you wear, investment advisor hat, broker-dealer hat, you're a pension fund advisor, you owe a fiduciary standard. You have to put the client's interest first, and you have to disclose. So the SEC is saying uniform fiduciary standard for everybody in their 246-page report.
And so what's the status of that now? The report's just been released, is that it?
It has been released. It's two, three, 4 weeks ago
came okay
out. It's very thorough, extensive. I met with the SEC a couple of times over their study. They were open, receptive. We gave several examples of the broker-dealers walking into these forums saying they don't owe a fiduciary duty. And now here's what we're concerned about now is that we think there's going to be a uniform fiduciary standard. The problem now is what we're hearing, which is SIFMA, which is the broker-dealer, saying, well, we're going to disclose in this laundry list. So you go to open an account. And what we're scared of is the SEC is going to say grace over this. You go to open an account, mom and pop at Merrill Lynch, and you get this laundry list
that buries everything, right?
Disclosures about every conflict of interest that could ever, and you got to sign. That's not meaningful disclosure. So
right,
what we're worried about is this check the box disclosure, and which is going to, I mean, it really is, you might as well not have it.
It's more or less like past performance is no future guarantee.
Oh,
yeah,
well,
right?
That's the best example. That's perfect. And that's exactly it. If it appears everywhere, it eradicates, it just nullifies the disclosure.
Right. It's got to be specific on really, it should be on basically every trade, every time, in every sort of function of any transaction, right, that this advisor
exactly
suggests.
Right. For instance, if you're selling, if you're putting together a bond portfolio because you're a retiree, and they have you in what they call a wrap fee account. This is just normal, everyday stuff. They charge you an ongoing fee. Well, that might be 50, 75, 100 basis points. It's a lot for bonds. They should tell you, look, bonds are buy and hold. You hold them for years. I'll charge you a commission. I'm not going to charge you a wrap fee. But those are the types of disclosures that we're talking about. Not a check the box, but something meaningful that's...
Now, let me just ask you this, because we're just about running out of time. But you're a private attorney.
Right.
You go to the SEC and you're helping them build these things? I mean, tell me, you know, like...
I went to the SEC. We picked up the phone and contacted the SEC. When I say we, I'm president of the securities bar, PIABA.
Ah, okay.
And it stands for Public Investors Arbitration Bar Association. And we represent investors in all kinds of different forms, primarily FINRA arbitration. FINRA is the SRO, the self-regulatory organization that governs the broker-dealers,
okay,
all right? And so I went on behalf of PIABA, which our mission is, it's investor advocates. It's protecting the investors in...
So, yeah, I mean, let me just give you, because, you know, this is another element of, you know, as I have been working with Mike more, that I'm becoming more and more aware of there's a proactive role here for plaintiff litigators, trial lawyers, insofar as that you want to help. Not only are you providing almost a sort of second level of regulatory protection for consumers or for workers, depending on the situation, but you guys actually go out and proactively push regulation, I guess presumably because you're raising the standards for what your future clients could expect.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's a mixture of, I mean, advocating our clients' rights. And it's not just our clients, but I mean, it makes you...
You're advocating for your clients' rights, but you're also building a whole new, another set of rights for a future class, essentially.
People that really don't have a voice. I mean, I met with Barney Frank when they were putting together Dodd-Frank. I went up and we met with dozens of folks in Congress as they were putting these together. And, you know, it was incredible. I mean, the Wall Street was everywhere. There's nobody standing up.
Right. There's got to be a whole team of lawyers on the other side who see you guys coming, and they're like, we're doing the same thing, except we're doing the opposite.
We were the only investor advocate group, PIABA, that went in front of the SEC, and there were dozens of broker-dealer groups that when they were putting together the study. It goes perfect with the name of your program. It's Silent Majority, and there's no voice for these people.
Right.
We're one of the only ones out there.
Well, Peter Mouget, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, and good luck with that. And we'll be in touch soon, and we'll get an update on what's happening with that. All right, folks. Now, this is the point of the show generally where I would do some outro music, and we would go to the flip side. I'm going to try and take some IMs and see how it goes. Let's see if I can maybe I can play a little bit of music here. Hold on for 1 second. Let's see if I can do this. Let's see. Bear with me for 1 second, folks. Tomorrow, just to let you know, I'm going to be interviewing Chris Rosen. I'm going to be pre-recording it and hopefully figuring out a way of playing audio like this. I don't know. I guess maybe there's a slight chance I may just put together the whole show while I'm out here tonight and then just play it as a podcast tomorrow. So you're going to have to check in with us. All right, folks. If you want to IM me, you could IM me at Majority FM. I will take your IMs and happy Thursday. Just one more note of house cleaning next week. All pre-recorded shows, but all new. I had some great interviews with Johan Hari, a British journalist, Ellen Ruppel Schell, who writes about, essentially, has a great book on, titled Cheap, really relevant in terms of that IKEA story that I talked about last week. David Sirota, Kevin Drum, James Howard Kunstler, Alfie Cohn. Great interviews all next week, even though I'll be on vacation. Can you believe it? All right, join me on the flip side. I'll take your IMs at Majority FM.